So this episode is with Dr. Maria Bellette, who is a cognitive neuroscientist, and we talk about her work discussing how psychedelic use in the wild or naturalistic psychedelic use might impact both people's cognition and their mental health. She's been involved with the Great British Intelligence Test, which allowed her to survey and collect cognitive data on a tremendous number of people. And these people, what's even more exciting, is that they were collecting data where it wasn't specifically for a psychedelic study. This is such a big problem in drug research, more broadly, is that you're getting a bunch of survey data from people who are interested in these drugs who want to be like, yes! You know, so this study was conducted in part without doing this. So that's quite exciting, really getting some answers as to how psychedelics might affect people in a more representative way. I'll also talk a bit about how difficult times globally might interact with mental health resilience in psychedelic users with some potentially unexpected results, depending on your personal biases. And then we also get into another topic that she's written a bit about, the nocebo effect. So, you know, in psychedelic science, people are always going on and on about the placebo effect. Oh, it's just expectancies. But expectancies can also be bad. And, you know, as people get more invested in understanding risk, it's going to become more and more important that how potential negative effects are discussed is nuanced in such a way to not provoke the nocebo effect. And we get into that a good deal. And also what good science communication looks like and kind of how science communication can influence what the public is thinking about. And also, you know, what scientists can actually learn from people interested in psychedelics. I think that's a really important topic that we touch on, and there's a good deal of discrepancy between what people who are interested in psychedelics are invested in learning more about and, you know, what scientists are focused more on. So she tries to bridge the gap a bit, which I really enjoyed our discussion there. And then finally, this is a bit of a far-reaching conversation, but we also talked about a recent case report that Maria wrote about how childbirth, of all things, can actually be in altered state, that for at least this woman in the case report was quite a psychedelic-like, pleasant experience. So we talk a bit about the implications there around, I guess, sudden setting with experiences beyond psychedelics, you know, and the research that she hopes happens there in the future. So this is quite a far-reaching conversation. The beginning is a little bit dense with her survey data. We get a little technical, but not too bad. But I really enjoyed hearing more about, like, what the public actually cares about. All right, so I am here with Maria Bellette, who has done quite a bit of very interesting research examining psychedelics and cognition, especially within the context of naturalistic use, which if you've been listening to this podcast, you'll know I think that naturalistic use is a huge area that has been understudied quite substantially. So Maria, maybe you could tell us a bit about your work.
Sure. I mean, that's a very broad question to begin with.
Yes.
I'll be happy to go ahead. So I'm a computational neuroscientist. I've been working in psychedelics research, I would say, for around 10 years, although my work is a lot broader than simply looking at psychedelics. I also look at other drugs, and I also look at at psychiatric and neurological conditions and how cognition might be affected in those cases. And it's quite a broad study of human cognition, altered states, and the environmental impacts in general. But I'm not going to lie, the psychedelic side of my work is actually one of the most fascinating and enduring interests of mine here. So one of the things that I have done in the past couple of years, for example, to address this, was running a study arm, which was part of the Great British Intelligence Test, which is a wider study of human intelligence and cognition, which is run by Professor Adam Hampshire, whom I've had the pleasure of working with for around 8 years at this point. And in leading this study arm on naturalistic drug use, one of the things that I've done was to survey a very large amount of British individuals. So we have a cohort that we've been monitoring longitudinally for around 5 years now, comprising of 135,000 individuals out of an original, I think it was around 700,000 signed up for the study to begin with. And yeah, I've been surveying them on their patterns of drug use and also carrying out mental health questionnaires and cognitive testing and so forth. So this is some of the work that I've been doing more recently. Specifically focusing on this aspect.
That is just a huge sample compared to a lot of studies that you've seen with like psychedelics. And a lot of times, a big problem that psychedelic research has is it's collecting data on people who are like, yes, I want to sign up for a psychedelic study.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you were able to kind of get around that. What were some of the interesting findings that you?
Well, I think you're making a very interesting point, first of all. And yes, we're very lucky to be working with a huge cohort of people. And this is due to the lab's past involvement with combining really our scientific expertise with public outreach activities. So we had this involvement with the BBC a couple of years ago in around 2019 and 2020, where we filmed a TV series with them and a Horizons documentary. In this way, we popularized our cognitive testing platform, which is called the Cognitron. And that's a precision cognitive testing technology, which we developed in our lab. And we gave the opportunity to as many people who would like to access the link to try out our cognitive testing, sign up for our study. And then they were able to view their results and see their, where they would place in a hierarchy, if you wish, relative to other people of their same demographic and same age and sex and so forth in the UK. And that would prove to be very popular. So that's how we had such a big sample. So this is like in response to the point that you made earlier about people signing up for studies because they're very interested in furthering a specific interest of theirs, if you wish. The drug use arm was only a study arm. It wasn't the main purpose of this study. So we didn't advertise that at some point we will ask people questions about drug use and so forth. This was only something that was implemented for the longitudinal arm of the study, whereas originally it was more just like collecting demographics and giving people cognitive testing. So they had to essentially agree to participate in further surveys. This is one of the biggest strengths of my study, I believe, because it wasn't particularly targeted towards identifying a specific subset of drug users, like a specific subset of psychedelics users, potentially those who have an interest in sharing their experience in research and furthering a specific belief or personal point of view that they might have about this. So yeah, the findings were quite interesting now that I am to come to this point, because so far I've only really published the mental health findings. There's plenty of data to go through and I'm still working through to like bringing to publication all of the findings. But the mental health cross-sectional data analysis from the early surveys that were carried out overlapping with the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic, for example, those are out. And the results were quite interesting there, I think, because they were quite unexpected. Essentially, what I've done there was to look in a data-driven way at the different patterns of drugs that people, patterns of drug use that individuals might have, and then looking at how individuals in those groups compare relative to people who are drug naive and they never use drugs in their life in terms of their mental health and resilience, specifically during the peak of the pandemic. And to the surprise of a lot of the readers of my work, those who are psychedelics, and I know psychedelics and cannabis users, because it turns out that people who only use psychedelics and do not consume cannabis are extremely rare. They had worse mental health during that period of time than drug naive individuals. But also in a contrasting analysis than those who only use cannabis and not psychedelics. So it's quite interesting, and I think at that time it raised quite a bit of discussion around why that might be and so forth, because a lot of people expected, I believe, people who use psychedelics to have a mental health advantage, I suppose, but that was not evident at that time in my research. So yeah, I would say this is an interesting starting point of the already published findings.
Yeah, it's refreshing to see psychedelic use not painted in such a glowing light, because I think now a lot of times anytime you read anything, it's like, oh, improves mindfulness, reduces depression, anxiety, whatever. But these are samples of people who want to show that psychedelics are good a lot of times.
Yeah, I
And
think.
you have such a large sample, and also to the people who are drawn to using psychedelics, maybe they have more problems to begin with, would be my guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of complexity and nuance here, I believe. I got very mixed reactions to these findings, honestly. Like, as you mentioned, there were some people who were calling it refreshing to see some different results. But I'll go into a bit of more depth in a minute about why I think the context of all of the why those results were negative matters a lot, and contextualize them a bit with a bit of more new recent results that I got from a longitudinal analysis of the same data. And also, I also had very interesting reactions presenting this at conferences with people asking me if I still have any friends left in this field of research after publishing this, which was very interesting to see how polarizing on a personal level such essentially data analysis, presenting scientific data, can be in this field of research. So that was quite an interesting thing to navigate. Yeah, adding some more nuance and detail to the complex interactions between drug use and mental health, right? So one of the other things that I wanted to, let me start a different way. So when I carried out this analysis, I did hypothesize that people who use psychedelics were going to have better mental health. That seemed, the reason why I started off the data analysis in this way was actually because I thought it's a very easy analysis that's going to have a very straightforward answer that everyone expects, and then I'll be able to move on to the subsequent ones. The fact that the result was unexpected was not something that I could have predicted based on all of the other research findings that were published up to that time. So while I was interpreting what this might mean, one of the things that I've noted was that a lot of the naturalistic studies of psychedelics use were actually using within subjects designs. So essentially, what that means is that when you look at people in a longitudinal fashion, you compare people today to themselves yesterday, or whatever time frame in between, but basically before and after a psychedelic experience. One of the things I thought at that time was that, well, maybe they make people feel a bit better than they themselves felt before the experience, but they don't make them feel mentally healthy or on par with individuals who've never used drugs, which is a better contextualization, really. So, since we were still collecting data at that point, now more recently, I've only just wrapped up a longitudinal analysis. And that's been submitted for publication. It's not yet out. So, something to look forward to, hopefully. But in this longitudinal analysis, it's quite evident that yes, people who use psychedelics did not have better mental health during the pandemic, but they did have longitudinal improvements in their own mental health. And now, currently, at this point in time when we're out of the pandemic, they are actually on par with people who are drug naive. So I thought that was quite interesting because essentially what it made me think was that, and this is where I'm at with my interpretation of these findings, is that perhaps what's going on is a heightened sensitivity in terms of mental health of people who use psychedelics to challenging situations, globally challenging situations, if you wish. Of course, that's just one interpretation. Like, there could be many reasons why during the pandemic they were struggling more than those who are drug naive. But one of the things that I've been considering, given all of the impact of set and setting on the psychedelic experience outcomes in the short and long term, is that essentially taking psychedelics during globally challenging times may not necessarily be associated with the best outcomes. But then for people who do it during more quiet, reasonable times, perhaps that is actually, beneficial for themselves at an individual level in terms of their mental health. And on a group level, it doesn't sway the direction of this group mean towards being either above or below those who are drug naive. So they don't have an advantage or a disadvantage. They're just regular mental health, I would suppose, there. So that would be some further contextualization of those findings.
Yeah, so it sounds like for people who use psychedelics, it might bring them more to a normal level in a good sort of social, well, broader social context. But then if things are dire in the world, then it might, you know, make them worse than the general population mental health wise. There were also some other interesting patterns. Like apparently one cluster in your group was reporting better mental health.
Yeah, that is true. And that's actually something that furthers my point about looking at different patterns of drug use. So MDMA, as we know, is often just grouped together with psychedelics for a reason that I don't really understand, other than some individuals report having similar subjective experiences. Although I would say on a more general level, they seem to be quite distinct drugs. And one of the things that emerged is that the group that consumed MDMA during the pandemic was different to the group who consumed psychedelics during the pandemic. And those who consumed MDMA also consumed in combination with cannabis. That doesn't mean necessarily taking it at the exact same time, but during the same period of time. And interestingly, this was the only group that showed better mental health scores during those acute global challenges. And I thought that was quite interesting once again. Well, I will preface this by saying that that was one of the smaller groups as well. So perhaps we shouldn't look too. It was just about 100 people or just under. And that's something to consider. Not many people took MDMA and cannabis, for the matter, during that acute period of the pandemic. But nevertheless, they did have better scores. I think this is actually quite important to look at, because if we were to group psychedelics and MDMA into the same category as some of the other research papers, for example, that have been published during the same period of time have done, this might lead to results that illustrate that, well, psychedelics are actually associated with better mental health. But is it due to the classical psychedelics or is it due to the MDMA? This, especially seeing that in my data, the associations go in completely opposite directions, I think it raises some important field level questions about why would we class all of these drugs that are actually distinct into the same group, and then which one drug do we actually attribute what drives the effects, what could potentially drive the effects and so forth. So, that would be quite a thing to keep looking into, I suppose. What would happen if all of the analysis of past data would be redone and MDMA is taken out? A bit of a scary thing.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, so many studies, they just focus maybe on the psychedelic use. But what this paper really made clear is that a lot of times if somebody's doing psychedelics, they're doing a bunch of other things. And then there are different clusters of users who have different patterns. So I think that's really important to consider, because there are definitely polysubstance using people out there who will do LSD and then go do meth. Like,
yeah,
that exists.
I mean, there's all sorts of patterns and choices that people make outside of controlled environments. And I think this needs to be acknowledged a bit more, because yeah, if we survey people on clearly their psychedelics use, and then whatever manner, and then we fail to account for the fact that they might just smoke weed all the day long. I'm not saying there's something wrong with doing whatever drugs people want to be doing. That's a completely separate conversation. It's more of like, for us as scientists, what matters is to be able to know what the effects we're studying are about, where they're from, and to be able to map that with precision. And I don't think that not accounting for polydrug use is helping anyone. It's actually a great historical problem. Drug users in general have been either studied as we're only going to survey on this drug and just report that people have used others, but we're actually going to base our whole message and interpretation on this one drug that we thought was interesting. Or there would be the other lines of research where all of the drug users are together in the same group relative to everyone else. And then that fails to account for all of the complexities and nuances of individual drugs, pharmacological classes, interacting with the systems in the brain, the subjective experiences, the way that those subjective experiences then carry on impacting everyday life and psyche and so forth. And yeah, I think we just need a bit of a restructuralization, if you wish, on the specific methodology on how we look at naturalistic patterns of drug use and how we interpret the findings that come after. And these are just considerations that I have been dealing with in my own research, and perhaps it's one way, and I'd be curious to look at other methods if people want to think about this, of course.
Yeah, I guess while we're on this topic of drug categories, I'm just going to mention when people use the term hallucinogen and they apply it to everything, they're like, oh, NMDA antagonist, ketamine, classic psychedelics, MDMA, PCP, cannabis, and let's interpret findings based on every single drug basically out there, almost, it feels like. It's just, yeah, so there's definitely a lot more room for nuance, and then also, you know, different, yeah, so.
I would say hallucinogen is also quite an outdated term. I mean, it's not really like the current practice to use it anymore, although some people still use it, and yeah, I think it's unfairly used for a lot of drugs, like even for psychedelics. Yeah, maybe the visual changes, the perceptual changes are quite drastic compared to everyday, but they're not hallucinations. Not in the way that the things that people see are. I think it's like quite a debate I don't necessarily want to go into here, but what tends to happen with psychedelics is an enhancement of what's already there, or a modulation of what's already there, rather than seeing completely new things, as in a new person is there in flesh and bones right next to you, as you would see with some delirians, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's like a nuance that is once again missed by that classification and old language that some people might use. So yeah.
Yeah. I do think it is an outdated term, but unfortunately some of the U.S. governmental surveys still use it. So yeah, creates problems. But so I guess switching gears a bit, you know, we've talked a bit about the positive expectancies with psychedelics kind of influencing some of the research that's been done and the discourse. What about sort of negative expectancies and the nocebo effect?
Yeah, and I published a paper on this recently. It was a bit of a backstory to this paper. It was a reactive paper to some of the conversations I was seeing on Twitter. Not this Christmas that just passed, the one before. I was happily at home enjoying my Christmas, where I've noticed that some relatively prominent, very well-followed people who have certain tangential interest in psychedelics suddenly started turning from praising psychedelics and how safe they are and so forth to being quite negative about the harms that could arise. And I just thought that was like a switch of gears, basically. Why, since you've been preaching about these substances for such a long time, now suddenly there seems to be a trend amongst certain groups where psychedelics are demonized once again. So I had a bit of a think about this during the Christmas holiday, and I wrote this quite reactive paper at that time, but I went on a rabbit hole of research into how the historical and cultural contexts where psychedelics are taken may influence experiences. And this goes to talk about things like how the cultural context of, for example, on a cultural level, people considering that certain drugs are bad or simply doing drugs is a demonic practice, really bar out their beliefs like this, or other pieces of historical, say, how should I call this, information such as if you take LSD once, it's going to turn you mad. For example, this has been quite a prevalent notion. I'm sure that in your research, you have actually looked at these historical examples over and over again. And what I thought was that the way that we talk about drug use is underestimated as a determinant in the drug experiences that happen at that time. And there's actually been quite a bit of anthropological and sociological research that has pointed at this in various ways before, at these associations, but it's never really been contextualized as this potential nocebo from how we speak about drugs and about people who use drugs, and to the people who use the drugs, especially. And yeah, not much care has gone into this, speech hygiene around drugs and drug use towards the users themselves. So that's why I decided to write this paper. I had my mom here, which very kindly babysat my toddler at that time, so I could lock myself in the room for a bit and write this paper, and then it got published, which I was very happy about. Essentially, it's just trying to raise attention to the fact that perhaps we should be minding the way that we describe psychedelic experiences, not only when we mind our way of influencing these positive expectations, but also the negative expectations, because it really goes both ways. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, you definitely see a bit of that in the late 60s, especially when, you know, there's articles coming out describing people developing psychosis from psychedelics. It's really unclear if you look at those papers a bit carefully if it's actually psychosis or if they're just having like profound anxiety or mania or whatever. It could be a bunch of things. But then, you know, you can read then like accounts in like the book, I think it's like the Psychedelic Experience book by Masters something. And he describes there a person who is familiar with sort of the psychedelics and psychosis narrative having an experience on psychedelics where he's like, I am experiencing, you know, thought disturbances, and, you know, I'm clearly becoming paranoid, just like, you know, all the media says I will. You know, it's clearly causing psychosis.
I think that's quite a bit of a tragedy, really, if people are experiencing those things and they're not really... It is a very intense experience, the psychedelic experience. So naturally, people might feel a bit shaken by it. A lot of people that experience already have a practice of letting go, so-called, and being able to just, you know, not overthink certain aspects of the experience whilst in the experience and so forth. But especially for first-time users, I'm thinking here, If you feel a bit challenged psychologically about what's going on during the experience, then if the only narrative they've been exposed before is essentially damning the mind-altering properties of these drugs and saying that, well, you're now insane forever, time alterations that take place during the psychedelic experience, of like people's perception of time changes as well. This is one of the effects. They might actually feel very unwell and have some of the symptoms you just described. But then, yeah, that's not because the drug does that. That's because the combination between the drug's effects and their interpretation and perception of the effects and how they interact with those in that state has gone through a filter that demonizes it. Yeah, there's quite an interesting example that goes hand in hand with this. So I was reading some clinical trials. Well, that was with ketamine, really. It was very interesting to see how the attrition rates would be different in different study arms across countries. So, for example, in the study arm in the US, people would give up on being part of the study when they would recognize them in the placebo arm. But then if you look at northern countries in Europe, like Sweden, which is a very conservative country from a drug laws and policies perspective, and also culturally, again, from a drugs perspective, drugs use perspective, that would be in the active drug arm. And again, I do wonder whether people would feel in that situation were actually associating the perceptual alterations with something negative and something that they don't want to have, something they don't want to be part of, and so forth. And yeah, I think in the more Western world, we are definitely in a bubble that we're not necessarily aware of, because psychedelics are not very well culturally integrated, or drugs with related effects or similar effects and so forth. The discourse might actually have an influence on all of these factors. Mm-hmm. It's like an invisible force driving it.
Yeah, it's difficult because It seems like people are interested in learning about the kind of experiences these drugs can provoke. And then, you're getting sensational accounts, swingingly positive or negative or whatnot. And then that's influencing the experience that they'll have. How would you sort of, I guess, in an ideal world, balance the information that people are exposed to?
That's very hard, very hard. Especially because what gets published in the media, online, anywhere, what gets to reach people is the most polarized and most, extremes at either side. And then you get to think about how biologically we are wired to perceive the negative as more impactful than the positive. And then what are people actually going to ruminate over? I would say it's actually not the fact that psychedelics are going to save everyone. That is my personal opinion on what is going on here and how to kind of prevent that. I think it's really hard in a culture that doesn't prioritize balanced discourse on things, where flashy things gain priority and so forth, where there's so much polarization. I think it's very hard. There's more polarization these days than ever on so many different topics. And I would also argue that as any topic that gains popularity, either for good or for bad reasons, it's gonna attract the polar opposite naturally as the topic becomes more and more prominent. So I think because we've had this bubble of positivity around psychedelics, that bubble naturally attracted the counter. Well, if they say that's all good, well, I'm gonna be the one who stands out and says it's not all good. And I think that's definitely happening, not only with psychedelics, with everything. Again, it's just, and there's quite a bit of research. Again, I think within the psychedelics field, sometimes we fail to acknowledge so many things that are happening have actually been researched over and over by pretty smart people. And this reactive way of commentary and social discourse has been researched before. It is what humans do. When there's a growing interest in something, the counter arguments are going to come up as well. And I think education is the key to addressing this, really. I currently don't really understand why drug use is not discussed in schools in ways other than negative, in a balanced way. Some people use coffee every single day. That's a drug. I think, again, it's a lot about language and the way that we phrase things and the way that we place various drugs within a constellation of drug use that humanity engages with all the damn time at the end of the day. And the nuance tends to lack. That's another thing. People like these bite-sized conclusions, very direct A to B. That's not how things work. And I think that's one of the ways in which, science can help to map out more specifics, but then science communication needs to come in and try to not oversimplify things or not like ascribe causation to correlation and so forth. There's there's a lot that needs to go in, but education is key, and having open dialogues and showing arguments of both sides and understanding where those arguments come from, and perhaps just helping people think for themselves rather than tell them what to think, help them reason through. And yeah, that's my hope for what's going to happen.
Yeah, getting people to reason these days seems to be challenging, but thinking about like the Great British Intelligence Test, that you got a bunch of people to complete a study that it really didn't benefit them at all. It wasn't really like, oh, we're gonna go create a narrative or whatever. It's just like we're gonna understand more about how the mind works. What?
Some of them, I think it benefited some of them. We do have quite a lot of people who email us back. When's the next time point coming? And when are you serving us next? Because,
Yeah.
as I mentioned before, we do provide them with their results, and they can see their evolution over time on all of these cognitive tests. And they can compare it with their friends if they're also participants in their
Yeah.
study. They can see whether they're getting better at anything or worse. They can see, in some cases, potentially might raise some alarm signals if things are not actually going that well, But yeah, in general, I think people have actually fed back that it was quite a positive experience to be part of our study, and they did find some benefits in getting those results. A lot of them said that it prompted them to read our papers, other people's papers,
Yes.
to try to understand what we're looking at. So I see that as a positive, really.
It is, but it's different than saying like, oh, your depression is going to go down.
Right. No, I, of course. Yeah, I know what you
It's
mean.
contributing to sort of an innate fascination with the topic and like a scientific sort of mindset where it's like, oh, we're going to go discover more about
Yeah.
how the mind and brain works. And I would
Yeah.
love to see more of that, in the psychedelic science communication, because that's, at least to me, like what really pulled me in was just how strange the experiences people can have are, and understanding how the brain is able to like create those
Yeah.
kinds of experiences. So I don't
Yeah.
know. I feel like that's a direction that the media could go that would balance things out.
No, absolutely. There's so many things that I can actually add here. So yeah, of course, the Great British Intelligence Test was not an intervention study. So like there wasn't a direct benefit to people's mental health in a way that we wanted them to benefit in their mental health practice. We don't tell people what to do with their lives. We just map out what they very kindly share about their lives. And yeah, in relation to like where the science communication is on psychedelics, I think there's a lot of work that needs to go in there. It's actually mind-blowing, some of the titles that we read in the media, and they're citing my colleagues' work sometimes completely differently from what a scientific reader would interpret it to be. And I would say that, yeah, ascribing causation to correlations is one of the biggest problems. But also using extremely metaphorical language to try to describe the effects that we may see from psychedelics in research without adequately saying that's a metaphor. I'm trying to think of like a specific example right now. I think there was like something to do with one of the earlier LSD studies, if I remember correctly. So almost a decade ago that. And someone said like scientists looked in the brain and discovered a lot of orange in response to the old brain maps, like where the blood, there was like more intense blood flow in certain areas. And I thought that was hilarious time, actually. But yeah, it's things like this that we should avoid in order to have a healthy conversation about psychedelics and what they do to the brain. And I agree wholeheartedly with you. Trying to understand this experience is really the most fascinating parts of the research. And it's surprising that it's not actually the most researched part. It's mental health that's most researched.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit bizarre to me, at least. But a paper that just came out today actually talks about a bit about what the public is actually interested in learning
Oh,
more
my paper.
about.
Yeah, my paper.
Yes,
Yeah.
your paper.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. Sure. Yeah, I can probably give a bit of a summary of what this new paper is about.
Sure,
So,
let's go.
long story short, over the past couple of years, I was very happy to be invited to deliver dozens of talks. I tried to count them. It's somewhere above 50, between 50 and 70. And those would be, for the majority of them, public talks, either at universities or to the general public and so forth on the science of psychedelics. And strictly for educational purposes, strictly trying to communicate scientific findings to the general public, I have a absolute passion for doing things like this, for teaching as well. And it's something that I hope to be able to keep doing for as long as possible and as long as my babies don't occasionally miss me that badly in the evenings when I might be away delivering talks. But it is one of the highlights of my academic career, I would say. And one of the things that I did over this past couple of years was always make notes of what people ask me, what people are interested in, and so forth. And that's strictly for personal interest. I do often think that as scientists, we can become a bit isolated sometimes, isolated either within ourselves because we spend so much time on our own thinking and trying to solve problems. And that's a bit of an echo chamber sometimes. But then there's another echo chamber, which is the other scientists who tend to be the primary people we spend time with. So always having these conversations and about what is actually happening with the psychedelic experience, for example. But really, the people who know what's happening with the psychedelic experience best are the people who take psychedelics.
And those are the people that I like talking to a lot because I want to know. I want to know, like, how was it? What did you do? Is it different to what we're saying you actually did? And why is that? What do you think we should actually be doing? How can we actually help you understand? How can we help you understand what's going on? Is there something that you think we should focus our time and your tax money on in some cases? So I've been doing this quite religiously, making notes after every single lecture that I would give. And I honestly had some really memorable moments and conversations and instances where I've been moved to tears by people's experiences with psychedelics. And yeah, I thought, I really wish some of my colleagues would also be in a position to listen to all of this. So that's why I decided to write this paper. It's called Public Priorities in Psychedelics Research. So I collated all of my notes and I put together this paper that deals with two matters. So like areas of interest where people are interested in us researchers investigating things more, and there isn't much out there really for these questions. I would always be amazed by how many diverse questions I get, and there's barely any paper to point them towards reading a bit more, or I just wouldn't know what to say without speculating, because you also don't want to be speculating in front of the general audience who might actually base their health and life decisions on what you're saying. I don't think that's good practice for the most of it, you know? And I just made a note of those areas of interest, hopefully inspiring future lines of research. But there were also some areas of concerns. There's been quite a lot of discussion, for example, about where are the indigenous voices in all of this line of research and news that have been emerging, because it seems that, and I quote my audience here, that it seems that some of your researchers really missed the point on what's going on. And that this is not a new thing, you know, it has been used by indigenous practitioners and in various cultures for millennia. We've just come across to it in the systematic fashion in the modern scientific era in the Western civilization, but there's still communities across the globe who have religious practices centered around psychedelics, who have entire cosmological and world views that are integrating these substances as being key components, whereas we're taking a different approach, you know. And one of the questions I kept getting was, where is all of that information in the new wave of looking at psychedelics? And another was about the interest of pharmaceutical companies and the monetization that is currently coming up. And that's a very difficult one, because obviously there's a lot of researchers who venture into the commercial side of things. And I would like to think the majority of them motivated by trying to help people. But what's actually the case is that obviously there's going to be cases where people are interested in monetization more than in what's actually happening. And one of the concerns that the audiences were voicing quite repeatedly was, well, isn't this just the same as continuing prohibition anyway, but putting a price on the experiences, which is further going to, you know, create a gap between those who can afford having psychedelic experiences and those who not, and those who can afford it, somehow those experiences might be perceived as legit, valuable, or allowed to have, which is a crazy thing to think about, you know, the choice of altering someone's consciousness, which rests with themselves. It's like some people might be allowed and some people not, but it seems to be a violation of human rights in one way, you know? Yeah, and also like there's been concerns about hypothetical scenarios. For example, well, after you pay many thousands of dollars or pounds or whatever the currency, and then you have this trip, what if it goes wrong? What's happening then? You know, what if you don't get the benefits that have been sold to you? At the end of the day, because if it's a service, if it's a product, and you don't get what you paid for, then what happens then? And honestly, I think there is quite a lot of validity to what people are asking here. And I didn't have the answers to give for a lot of these questions. You know, what's going to happen? I only have what I know and what my opinion is and what I care and see is going on. But it's very hard to predict where we're actually going to be here. Coming back to naturalistic drug use, a lot of people were interested in safety guidelines. There doesn't seem to be much of a focus, and I find that crazy. There's not much of a focus on enhancing in a you know, scientifically evidenced way, an empirical way. There is some good research coming out recently. There's a group that's trying to, you know, put a lot of harm reduction guidelines out recently. Jules Evans and a couple of others are working on this. Yeah, on a general level, I would say the majority of people were just interested in evidence-based harm reduction guidelines and how to prevent having a bad trip. That was like the main thing that people were interested in. And yeah, how to use scientific evidence to like help with that, to understand what's going on,
oh, man,
so forth. It's not about how they can pay for treatments. At least that's not the audience that I had. Maybe other people mm-hmm. have different experiences. I really encourage them to share what their experience touring the country is lecturing. And yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think it really highlights the importance of studying naturalistic use, because these people are out there and they're going to keep doing drugs. And we're not really studying, you know, how can these people not be harmed. We're just like, you know, maybe their depression will go down if we follow them, and not seeing, you know.
Yeah, I think there's like great work going on in mental health and so forth, and the trials and everything. Some people can really be helped by that. You know, no doubt some people would benefit from the therapy. But the majority of people who use psychedelics don't actually use it for mental health benefits. And this is some work in progress I'm working on at the moment, just trying to understand what the reasons between using drugs are. And it's a surprise. It's less than a fifth of people, in my sample at least, that use drugs for mental health purposes. You want to guess what the number one reason why people use drugs is?
For fun.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
That's absolutely it.
And people...
It's almost taboo to talk about this, but that's the reality. That's what's actually happening in the world. People want to have fun. They want to drop acid with their friends and laugh their weekend away. That's what people want, you know? At a group level, and again, I'm not trying to dismiss the mental health research. I generally believe it's extremely important. But I think it's a matter of the scale of issue and presenting the global picture of what's actually important. And like, if we address the needs of one subset of individuals, namely those with mental health problems, well, how do we address the fact that some people want to alter their consciousness on a weekend, want to take all of the safety measures available, and want to have a good time, and they don't have any issue with their mental health, maybe they're not affected in their everyday lives and so forth. And I don't think it's fair to dismiss those people. I don't think it's fair to dismiss any group, really. And that's the group that I'm interested in, really. The whole population who uses drugs for whatever reason they want to use the drugs for. And if they very kindly want to share their data with me, then I may be able to inform research about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seemed like they, also looking at this paper, had a lot of interest in topics that aren't that well researched. So maybe you could share.
Autism spectrum disorders. So that was actually my biggest surprise. I know there's been quite a lot of interest in neurodivergence more generally in the population in the past years. But what I didn't expect is people asking repeatedly, like, without fail, every single lecture I gave out of those many, there were at least a couple of people who wanted to know what's happening with autism spectrum disorders and interactions with psychedelics. Now, there's some historical research where psychedelics have been proposed as a treatment for neurodivergence. That's not what people were asking about. They don't want to be treated. And I put in the camera, I probably will probably not show in the recording.
Quotes, air quotes.
For treating here. That's not what people are interested in. They're interested in how does the experience of people who are neurodivergent differ from those who are not neurodivergent in terms of like perceptual differences or outcome differences and so forth. And the other things that they're interested in is, well, if I'm neurodivergent, I know I'm neurodivergent, but I'm also interested in psychedelics. I really want to try it. How can I stay safe? So coming back to harm reduction. Yeah, and that seems to be, people are not interested in no longer being neurodivergent by using psychedelics. they're simply interested, you know, they have a curiosity in exploration and so forth, which is on par with everyone else's curiosity in psychedelics. But it's not from a treatment perspective. It's from an experiential perspective. It's like furthering the landscape of consciousness they have access to. Little thing called life that's not actually that long.
Yeah. I think that there's definitely a lot. There needs to be more focus on understanding neurodivergent, and I say that broadly, like how those people respond to psychedelics, if their experiences are different and whatnot. I was like, I focus on studying psychedelics and psychotic disorders, and I would say psychotic disorders almost fit into kind of a neurodivergent category.
I was going to say, because also, actually that came up quite a lot as well. So there were two kind of streams here. So there was like one stream of questions that was about, well, the audience members would say, well, I heard that if you do psychedelics, you're going to go crazy. Or you're going to go insane, or you're going to jump out of a window, the famous example. Or you're going to turn psychotic, you're going to get schizophrenia, basically. And everything you mentioned in your talk doesn't say at any point, well, people who did this, they all turned schizophrenic or psychotic after the experience. So why is that? And so forth. And I think, yeah, there was quite a lot of interest, but then there was a second stream here as well, which were people who had psychosis or schizophrenia. They knew this because they have been diagnosed. And nevertheless, they wanted to try psychedelics. And what they were saying is that they don't actually know what to expect. And they're worried whether it's actually a good or a bad thing, but they're curious. And should they be the guinea pigs on themselves? Or how can they... A lot of people wanted to volunteer in research studies, actually. A lot of people were like, well, if I do it, who can I tell about it? And like, or like, how can I volunteer in a study? Because I think, very interestingly, a lot of people actually think that if they volunteer as part of a study, it's almost like a bit of a safer way. But that's for intervention studies, strictly for intervention studies. Like if they go to a lab and they are dosed with a certain substance that has been clearly drug tested, they know it's pure and so forth, and they do it in a company of a researcher. A lot of people were interested in doing this sort of experiments and, yeah, contributing to the body of knowledge that we have and so forth. So I think it's definitely a very interesting line of work. And you've probably noted in your own research, it's not that there are not many studies to compare your data against. Which basically means that when audience members ask these questions, that actually not that much information to give them to answer their questions. And that's why I made a note of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say, not getting too much into the papers that I've been working on, but one thing I definitely am noticing is that, you know, people with psychotic disorders, because, you know, it's kind of a neurodevelopmental condition, people's brains vary a lot more with psychotic disorders than with other conditions, in part due to that, that there's a tremendous variability in response. And I would assume that might be the same with things like autism spectrum. So being able to parse out what is going on with using psychedelics in people with neurodivergent disorders, that is a huge topic. And
yeah,
studies need to probe what's going on, you know, with studying naturalistic use first, because it's probably already happening, you know?
I mean, like the first obvious step is just, I'm not going to name drop, but I know someone who has some data on this, and like I've been trying to convince them to work on that paper faster, because a lot of people are asking about it. But yeah, like the first obvious thing is just to run a survey and try to look at the associations and so forth. So yeah, trying to ask people, so what has it been like? What has the experience been like? And yeah, perhaps ask them what steps they did, if they, and then correlate that whether the experience turned out good or not. Dosages, dose dependency is a very important thing with psychedelics as well. So yeah, I really hope that someone delves into this field of research and then people can get their answers. That's the hope.
For sure. I guess the last topic I read about you writing a bit about was you published a birth case report where somebody was comparing childbirth, of all things, to a psilocybin-like experience.
It, yeah, that paper is hands down the most important paper I've ever written. I'm not gonna, like, I absolutely love my main field of research, but I think this is the most important paper I've ever written so far. Hopefully there's more coming up in the future that are on par with this one, but so far I think this is the most important thing that I've published. So it's a case report, and just a bit of a backstory here. I have two children myself, so I've been around a lot of pregnant women as a result of this, participating in all sorts of like community activities, yoga classes, whatnot, while I was pregnant myself. And I had the opportunity of chatting with a lot of different mothers and seeing a lot of different perspectives on childbirth. And yeah, I think that's what emerged. It's like when last year there was this person, we'll call her Emma, just for like privacy purposes. When one of the co-authors on that paper witnessed the birth directly. And essentially, the experiences that she had were pretty much spot on similar to the come up of psilocybin. With given my work with naturalistic drug use and so forth, that's why I participate in writing this case report. I thought the similarities were absolutely incredible. And I also thought that, yeah, exactly as you mentioned, childbirth out of all things, well, childbirth out of all things that are portrayed a certain way did seem to be extremely similar to an altered state. And what I'll mention is that the birth in question has been, it happened in a home setting. It wasn't a hospital setting. It was completely unmedicated and it wasn't attended by medical professionals. So although the paper has been written in collaboration with midwives, so like there has been like midwifery expertise that has been, that has gone into interpreting these findings and so forth. And there is a lot to discuss here, but the reason why I believe it's so significant is because exactly because of this, childbirth is not portrayed as an altered state, let alone as a positive experience. It's portrayed as an extremely painful, traumatic experience that women just have to go through. And very often they actually suffer quite a lot in the process. And that's not good, because if the mothers suffer, then that will negatively impact their families, their children, and society at large. It's all a downstream from there. If mothers suffer, everyone else from that chain of reactions onwards suffers. So it seems obvious to me that trying to minimize suffering is important. And it seems obvious to me that if someone has had a positive experience, perhaps there's something to learn from that that may help other people achieve positive experiences. So yeah, that's the reason why I put quite a lot of time into writing this. It's a pretty lengthy case report as well, I will say. Yeah, when I first came into contact with this, I went down a rabbit hole of reading the medical literature because I thought, sure, this is widely documented, experiencing like altered states during childbirth. Turns out it's documented in some popular books and some people have mentioned it. But it's not ever been systematically studied, and there isn't much in the medical field related to how childbirth is an altered state. So I thought this is an obvious gap that needs to be bridged. And yeah, I'm actually in the process of launching a study to research this phenomenon. And yeah, I'm hoping that later this year I'll have some findings to at scale. Be able to describe prevalence, perhaps phenomenology, what's happening, and so forth. I generally believe it's one of the most important areas of research.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it really speaks to the importance of set and setting, I guess, broadly. Because, you know, that applies to so much more than just doing psychedelics. It seems to kind of apply to everything in our lives to an extent.
Yeah,
especially
a psychological component. And I think that's one of the, I mean, obviously there's been modern advancements in obstetrics have helped save countless of lives. I'm not doubting that at all. But I'll tell you anecdotally from my friends' experiences, all of the women I spoke to, all of the professionals I've seen. I had the misfortune of having extremely challenging pregnancies. And I, like, with one of my pregnancies, I spent half of the time in hospital. It was pretty bad. Like, I got to speak to a lot of professionals, a lot of other pregnant women and so forth. The way that mothers are treated while they give birth is one of the number one things that they remember and they come back to when they recall whether it was a good or a bad experience. And it seems that very often, the process of giving birth lacks the psychological acknowledgement, the acknowledgement for the psychological dimension. And yes, the majority of births tend to happen in hospitals nowadays, which is, yes, to minimize risks indeed. But on a different note, if you look at it statistically, and I delved into this quite a lot whilst writing this paper, this is all in the paper. I really encourage people to go and read it because it's very important, in my opinion. But it's like, let me tell you some of the things that I found out from the medical literature. So in the UK, the rate of C-sections is about a third of women. There's countries where it's about 50%. That's crazy. That's crazy because we are born with a body that supposedly should be able to give birth, evolutionarily speaking, because otherwise we wouldn't be here, any of us. Then this raises some questions. What's actually happening with a third or almost half of the female population of certain countries? Why do they need to have surgical interventions? Many of these which were not elective, but emergency cases. And then there was this very interesting study I told about the time of the day when women give birth. And if you look at the countries that have a healthcare system, like many countries in Europe, that's not the case in the US, you will see that the peak hour to give birth is around 3 a.m. in the morning. And then if you look at the US, it turns out that most births happen between 9 and 5 in the day. And then this raises some questions about what we're actually doing with this process of childbirth, which is supposedly something that we're born with the ability of doing as women. And again, as I mentioned, I went down a rabbit hole of reading as much medical literature in writing this paper as possible. And what stands out to me is that the process has been really taken out of its environment, which used to be the home setting, and it used to be midwives, old women attending births and focusing on psychologically supporting the mother through hours and hours and hours until the baby is there. Obviously, there's been complications and fatalities through history. This is why obstetrics emerged. But then think about how different this instinctual practice is compared to being on a schedule and going into the hospital where a lot of things are scheduled, timed, and perhaps not everyone fits within those timelines, and not because of abnormalities, but because we are different. The amount of low-risk pregnancies is actually very low nowadays. I don't have the exact proportion of that to hand, but it's not the majority. It's not the majority of women who have a low risk. And I really wonder, given the dropping birth rates and so forth, why is this like a side interest of modern science? Perhaps there's something detrimental in the approach that we're having, not only to individual women, but also more globally, that's contributing to this. I mean, who would like to go through a horrible experience over and over again, right? So like, why would people have more children? On the other hand, it seems like an evolutionary good thing to have, to go to a positive experience and to want to do it again, because it was like that intense. Same reason why people keep coming back to psychedelics. Perhaps if people have good birth experiences, they're going to keep wanting to have children, and they're going to keep increasing the amount of people on Earth, and civilization is going to make it.
Yeah, so you were really kind of hoping that, you know, maybe getting some positive experiences out there, it changes the expectancies going into childbirth, where
precisely.
People aren't, yeah, having terrible precisely. Experiences.
Absolutely, precisely, yeah. I think there's a lot of bad stories out there. And yeah, absolutely, like, I know from the circles I've been in, everyone wants to tell you about their horrible experience. It's very rare that someone comes to you and says, like, no, look, this can be great. This can be wonderful. It could be, like, yeah, not the most important experience of your life solely because you're getting a human, a whole human at the end of it, which is so special in itself. But also because it can feel good and make you feel empowered. And, like, you've just witnessed, you know, the meaning of life like you do on psychedelics. So, yeah.
Very cool. Anything else you'd like to say about people's reactions to that paper?
It's been mixed. I've released it as a preprint. There's a reason for that. So I've also had the chance of presenting it at the conference, just before, at the satellite event at ASSC. So that's the Association for the Scientific Study of Consciousness, which was in Tokyo last year. I had the chance of presenting it, and the reception was phenomenal. I was absolutely thrilled to see so many consciousness researchers interested in the consciousness alterations during childbirth, which were not the main topic. I think, yeah, it was only my presentation on this topic. It's, as I mentioned, a surprisingly under-researched phenomenon. I hoped that the positive reactions would generalize. I've not received those positive reactions from other lines of research. I'm not going to name drop, but I will say that a couple of midwifery colleges I sent this to told me it's not a priority to look at this, or that this type of ideas don't gather support amongst them. I'm quoting here. These are not my wordings. So yeah, I'm going to keep trying to see who's interested in actually keeping this in a journal. So yeah.
Yeah, I really liked it. So
well, thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks to Open Science and preprints, it's already in the public domain, and I'm very happy with that. And yeah, I'll keep trying to see it published. I'm hoping that as time goes, the reception will be different. But really, it's, you know, scientists perhaps were very conservative in accepting things that differ to the status quo. And there's quite a bit of research that's been published in Nature recently discussing how things that disrupt the status quo are not necessarily the ones that make it. Say so, but I'd really hope that perhaps it reaches people who are pregnant or want to have children and see that, you know, birth can have a different look than what's mainly portrayed in the media, and it's not all screens. The woman in this case report was laughing the whole time and crying because, you know, she was so happy she couldn't understand why no one told her that's what it's gonna be like. It was quite interesting. It's quite interesting to be able to write about this and so forth. So yeah.
I guess zooming out a bit, what I guess is like the core sort of takeaway you want people to get from your research, and any messages for psychedelic science in general, I suppose?
Well, that's a hard one. It's a hard one. There's a lot of pressure on saying something. I think if there's anything that I would like to say is that there's a lot of value in a couple of different things. There's a lot of value in listening to people and hearing diverse perspectives. It's very important, especially people that you disagree with, especially people who tell you you're wrong about something. Listen to those. Yeah, and I don't try to ostracize people who perhaps don't fit your narrative or your research's narrative and so forth. Don't exclude those data points if you wish to speak in those terms. Second of all, learn some statistics for the science, for like anyone who's like an aspiring scientist, I would say. It's like, I really urge people, especially like early in their careers, to like truly look into statistics and like why certain tests may work and what sort of inferences you can draw from it and so forth. Super interesting, super important. It's more important than having great ideas, knowing how to like look at them statistically, because that's going to drive like kind of where your scientific outputs come out from. And the third one, there has to be a third one, I would say keep being creative and don't try, like, scientists, people, anyone, don't necessarily try to go for pre-established patterns on how to do things or what you should be doing. It's not career suicide to study psychedelics anymore. I was told that all throughout university, it's not. But also, like, I think, as with all scientific fields, there's always a danger that we're going to become complacent and just take things for granted. Yeah, keep challenging, keep being creative in the way things are challenged. That's what science is about. Challenge things until you can't challenge them anymore because they're that solid. That's the only way to get to the truth. Yeah. I think that's a good
thing. All right. Yes, 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 yes. Yeah, definitely agree with listening to people. And, you know, I wish I'd learned more stats early on. And now I'm just like, ah, I better. Yeah, but that's a whole nother.
Was having to delve into like how to test distributions for normality and so forth, where we're already run off the statistical tests.
Yeah. And like right now, I would say like there's almost no idea in psychedelic science that is so established that it can't be challenged. Like there are so many unknowns. You know,
there's some candidates. So let's start with challenging those.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been lovely to have a chat. And yeah, I hope to see you this year at maybe some conferences or something.
Yeah. Yes. Alrighty. All right. Bye.
Bye.